Hello and welcome back to our digital class on soft condensed matter. This is the third lesson unit out of the four on the topic of rheology. In our last lesson unit, we have got to know how rheology is practically conducted from both experimental and theoretical viewpoints. We have gotten to know typical experimental methodologies to carry out rheological experiments, and we have gotten to know two very simplifying but actually very powerful mechanical models to both simplify and quantify the mechanical characteristics, like the time-dependent stress relaxation or creep, of viscoelastic materials, the Maxwell model and the Kelvin-Voigt model. From all this consideration, we have seen that all the relevant quantities in rheology, like the elastic modulus or the viscosity, are time-dependent, which we can also express inversely as frequency dependence. And we have made ourselves clear already several times through our discussion that for soft matter, we expect this time dependence to be quite pronounced, as a very decisive time on the time scale is the relaxation time, which is the time it takes for the building blocks of a material to move over distances equal to their own size, and which therefore delimits the realm of more viscous behavior from the realm of more elastic behavior. And for soft matter materials, we have mentioned a couple times now throughout our lecture already that this relaxation time is on the scale of milliseconds to seconds, sometimes minutes to hours. And that means that on both sides, this limiting time, on shorter and longer times, we have to look a couple of orders of magnitude further, which means the rheological behavior of soft matter spans multiple orders of magnitude on the time scale because its relaxation processes take comparably long times. Today, we want to discuss this further and will realize from this two very elementary superposition principles, the Boltzmann superposition principle and the principle of time-temperature superposition. As it will turn out, the latter is very useful actually, because it introduces another very important fundamental variable which has dramatic impact on the rheological properties of materials, temperature. We can get a qualitative guess about this already. Relaxation processes have to do with motion. And motion is, like many other processes in nature, thermally activated. It occurs quicker at higher temperatures and vice versa. Or, if we want to express this from the viewpoint of frequency, certain relaxation processes in the material happen more often per time if temperature is higher, and vice versa. This indicates to us already that relaxation processes that take a certain time at that temperature take a shorter time at higher temperature, and again, vice versa. And this implies already that maybe we can replace mechanical spectra measured at that temperature and that time versus this temperature and this time to each other, if they respectively correspond to each other. And this does also imply that perhaps mechanical spectra may actually add upon each other. Ones that are measured at high temperatures and ones that are measured at low temperatures may be able to superimpose and thereby add to each other to create a greater mechanical spectrum, spanning longer timescales than any of the two individually. And this is indeed the case. We will discuss this in detail in this lesson unit. Before coming to that, we regard another phenomenon, which is equally relevant, the so-called Boltzmann superposition principle. We have seen already that relaxation and creep processes in viscoelastic materials take considerable timescales, on the scale of some seconds to minutes, sometimes even up to hours. So far, we have typically considered an external condition of a time-constant stress or strain exerted on the material. In many of the illustrations and considerations so far, we have considered time-dependent box profiles for the application of an external stress or strain. And we have seen that over the duration of application of a certain stress or strain, the respective other quantity, strain or stress, will show a time-dependent creep or relaxation that may or may not come to completion on the time window of application of the external load, depending on how quick or slow the processes happen. When we now think about that in this time window, we apply a second load to the material, we can guess already that a second creep or relaxation will add on top of the first, not yet completed one. And this is exactly what the Boltzmann superposition principle expresses, as sketched in figure 4.16. It does tell nothing less that a viscoelastic material or system remembers former deformations or stresses and continues to creep or relax from these, even if new ones are applied on top. Quantitatively, we can formulate this like it's done in equation 4.63 for a sum of different incident strains, here in this case, shear strains. According to Hooke's law, each will result in a stress in the material, which also sum up, as formulated in equation 4.64. In this equation, t denotes the time of measurement, whereas ti denotes the time of application of the individual strain increments gamma e. We can turn the sum into an integral if we consider the case of a continuous change, as it's written in equation 4.65. This integral can be solved if we have a suitable expression for the time-dependent modulus at hand. As a simple example, let's take the relaxation function from the Maxwell model, after which the modulus relaxes according to an exponential function, as it's denoted in equation 4.66. Plugging this into the preceding equation gives us equation 4.67, which we can rearrange to derive a very fundamental rheological relation, equation 4.68. Viscosity is modulus times relaxation time. We came across this equation already in our last lesson unit, more or less as a byproduct from considering the Maxwell element. Here we have derived it properly, so to speak, from the Boltzmann superposition principle. This is a very fundamental equation. It connects the three elementary mechanical material parameters to each other: viscosity, modulus, and relaxation time. Viscosity and modulus being macroscopic quantities, macroscopic material properties, whereas the relaxation time denotes a microscopic characteristic material parameter. As a result, this equation does denote us nothing else than a very elementary structure property relation. It defines flow as a relaxation process, in which the viscosity is composed of how much energy is initially stored into a material upon application external loads to it, and how long it takes to relax those. So far, this consideration was for monodisperse samples only, where all the building blocks have the same relaxation time. In the more complicated case of a polydisperse system, for example, a polydisperse polymer solution or melt, we obtain a polydisperse relaxation time spectrum. And the viscosity is then expressed as the sum of multiple relaxation contributions, as denoted in equations 4.69 and 4.70. In summary, we can say that relaxation occurs on a timescale tau, or on a time spectrum of multiple such overlaying taus, and these relaxation processes determine the viscosity by the elementary formula eta is g, or e respectively, times tau. Let us now take a second step, and also take into consideration temperature dependencies. Relaxation, flow, requires the molecules or particles that constitute material to change their positions. This necessitates them to move against each other, to slip against each other, for which they have to overcome an energetic activation barrier. Also, and furthermore, this necessitates sufficient free volume in the surrounding for them to move into. Both these prerequisites are temperature dependent, which means that, conceptually, they can be treated together like an effective energy of activation barrier that determines the temperature dependent frequency with which positional changes will occur. This is denoted in equation 4.71. It tells us that the relaxation time, which, as we have just seen, is directly proportional to viscosity, depends on an energy of activation for microscopic motion processes of the building blocks of our material, times another exponential dependence for finding enough free volume in the vicinity. In this equation, Vf is the free volume in the system, whereas V star is the volume that is required for each microscopic building block motion. Both those quantities are in turn temperature dependent as well, and so both these exponentials can be combined to something like an effective exponential, wherein which the actual energy of activation and the free volume contributions merge to some kind of effective energy of activation. And this effective energy of activation is overcome more often at high temperatures, which means that the microscopic building block motion processes happen more often at higher temperatures, denoting the viscosity and with that also the relaxation time to become smaller, and vice versa. The same concept you came across already in a very related form when you considered reaction kinetics. There you have done the very same estimate in the context of discussing the Arrhenius type of dependence of the kinetic rate constant of chemical reactions and its dependence on temperature. And you have seen that there the rate constant increases when temperature increases, whereas it decreases when temperature decreases. The rate constant in turn is inversely proportional to a characteristic time parameter, which is the half time, denoting the time it takes for half of the molecules in a given ensemble to react. And so this means, at increasing temperature, the half-time drops, and vice versa, as we have also just found it for the case of flow processes and the microscopic origin of them, building block rearrangement, in the context of equation 4.71. The lowest possible temperature at which movement is still possible is a very special one. It's named the glass transition temperature, often denoted as TG. Below this temperature, thermal activation is not possible anymore, but instead all movement of a material's building blocks is frozen and the relaxation time is infinity. The fundamental connection of temperature to the rate of relaxation, which in turn is connected to the viscosity, allows us to take rheological data that were recorded at a set of different temperatures, such to superimpose them on a common time axis. This is done by shifting these data along the time axis by the application of so-called shift factors, as denoted in equation 4.72. The modulus measured at a certain time t and a certain temperature capital T will be the same one on a shifted time axis t over a and a different temperature capital T0. For completeness, there is also a second shift factor in this equation b, which shifts the modulus not on its time axis but rescales it on its modulus axis. This takes into account potential changes in density of a sample, for example, that occur when measuring it at two different temperatures. In some textbooks, this factor is actually even omitted and not present in the equation. So don't be confused if you find this equation without the factor B. For the temperature capital T0, we often choose a suitable standard reference temperature, which is either room temperature, for practical reasons, or the material's respective glass transition temperature, TG. These shift factors are not just empirical, arbitrary quantities, but they can be actually conceptualized and understood. This is done, for example, in the context of the Williams-Lendel-Ferry equation. This equation gives the shift factor A as a function of temperature T in relation to the glass transition temperature as a reference state on the basis of free volume considerations, as it's denoted in equation 4.73. The very striking aspect about this equation is that it has universal quantitative factors in it, a factor of 17.44 in its numerator and a factor of 51.6 Kelvin in its denominator. These are universal and apply for many different polymer materials if we choose the respective glass transition temperature of the material as the reference temperature. This tells us already that the free volume concept has some very striking universality at the glass transition point and is closely connected to the phenomenon of the glass transition. We will consider this in more detail in our next lesson unit. For the moment, we take this equation simply as a means to quantitatively calculate the shift factors. In a practical case at hand, however, we can also just empirically determine them by recording rheological data on suitable time or frequency ranges, which are experimentally accessible to us at different temperatures, and then shift them on the time or frequency axis such that they best add to each other to build a large rheological spectrum. This is shown in figure 4.17. On the right-hand side of this figure, you see different branches of data sets. These are all mechanical spectra of a material. In this case, it's polyvinyl methyl ether with a molar mass of 124,000 grams per mole, measured at different temperatures. We can then take these data and shift them on the frequency axis such that they superimpose and add to each other to give a master curve, as shown on the left-hand side of this figure. This master curve shows us a full rheological spectrum of this polymer, which now spans 12 decades, 12 orders of magnitude on the frequency axis, and furthermore, 6 up to 7 orders of magnitude on the modulus axis. This shows us how different and how versatile the mechanical properties of these polymers are on different time or frequency scales. And very remarkably, these frequency domains, or their corresponding time domains, span a very huge range. For orientation, on the right-hand side, we have frequencies of 1 or 10 or 100 hertz, or more precisely, radian per second, if expressed as a circular frequency. These correspond to timescales of a second or a part of a second. Whereas in the other extreme, on the far left of this frequency axis, we have frequencies of 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 8 hertz, or radian per second. These correspond to timescales of a year or 10 years or even 100 years. So these are timescales that we could never access practically in experiments. But we can indirectly get an idea of the mechanical properties of the material on those super long timescales when we conduct the respective measurements on shorter timescales or higher frequencies, but at higher temperatures, where the relaxation processes that at the reference temperature, which here is the glass transition temperature, would occur on the timescale of years or decades or centuries, take only minutes to hours if we measure them at considerably higher temperature. This is all made possible by the principle of time-temperature superposition, which relies on the elementary fundamental principle that relaxation processes in material are thermally activated, and we can treat them by an effective energy of activation concept. Figure 4.18 shows us again the full mechanical spectrum of a polymer sample, now in a schematic fashion, and now with a flipped abscissa. Here it's not plotted as a function of frequency, but its inverse, time, which, as we have just seen, is interconvertible also to temperature. So we could either plot small t, denoting time, or capital T, denoting temperature, on this axis. The representation is a log-log plot, because we want to span multiple ranges on both scales. Again, we see, as we have also seen for the real experimental data in figure 4.17, that polymer samples display multiple different kinds of mechanical behavior spanning diverse ranges on the modulus and time axis, with also orders of magnitude different values on either. Let us attempt to understand this full rheological spectrum of polymers. When never having seen experimental data like the ones in figure 4.17, how could we expect the rheological spectrum of a polymer material to look like? Well, in our last lesson unit, we have already seen a very simple kind of full mechanical spectrum, the frequency-dependent course of the moduli, the storage and loss modulus, for a Maxwell element. And we have seen that this spectrum basically consists of two regimes. A flow regime on times longer than the relaxation time, where the specimen displays viscous flow, as timescales are long enough for microscopic rearrangements of its building blocks to happen. By contrast, on short timescales, respectively high frequencies, no such processes can yet happen, and the material does not yet exhibit flow, but by contrast exhibits elasticity. The delimiting time between these two ranges is the relaxation time, or its inverse when we denote it on a frequency scale. For polymers, we could actually also expect such a simple case, because polymers are a stereotype example of viscoelastic materials. There are just some deviations from the very harsh simplification that we do when modeling it in terms of the Maxwell model. The first deviation is that polymers do not exhibit one unique relaxation time. They actually exhibit multiple relaxation times. Because relaxation for a polymer can happen such that the entire polymer displaces over distances equal to its own size, this would correspond to macroscopic flow, but also there can be motion of the segments in the polymer coil against each other, whereas not yet the coil as a whole displaces. This is also an energy dissipation means, which, however, does not yet correspond to macroscopic flow. And so a polymer actually delimits multiple relaxation times of different length. The longest one is the one upon which the entire coil displaces over distances equal to its own size. The shortest one is the one that it takes for at least single monomer units inside the coil to displace over distances equal to their own size. And we can think about a whole lot of further relaxation times in between these two that it takes for multiples of monomer units, groups of monomer units, to displace over distances equal to their own size. As such, we would expect three regimes for the relaxation spectrum of a polymer. One regime at long timescales, again corresponding to macroscopic flow, that should look similar to the one we know from the Maxwell model. By contrast, also one regime corresponding to very short timescales, corresponding to an elastic material where no relaxations happen whatsoever, that should also look like very similar to what we have seen from the Maxwell model. And one section in between that corresponds to relaxation of chain internal motions, but not yet motion of the coils as a whole. And indeed, this is what we actually observe for polymers. We often observe even more, namely a fourth regime in the spectrum, which comes into play if the chains are long enough to entangle with each other. This will create another characteristic regime where motion is hindered by the mutual entanglements. And therefore, in the case of such a polymer, which usually is the case for long enough polymers that are able to entangle, we expect a mechanical spectrum consisting of four regimes. And this is exactly what we see in figure 4.18. We have four regimes. A glassy regime at very short times or low temperatures, a leather-like viscoelastic regime on longer timescales or higher temperatures. This occurs at around the glass transition temperature. An intermediate, so-called rubbery plateau, and a terminal viscous flow regime. This latter one can be described by the Maxwell model, whereas the intermediate leather-like regime can be nicely described by the Kelvin-Voigt model. We can also quantitatively understand these spectra. As already just said one sentence earlier, the terminal flow region, which is the right-hand side extreme of figure 4.18, or respectively the left-hand side extreme of the real dataset shown in figure 4.17, is described by the Maxwell model. Indeed, if we look upon the scaling here, we see a power law scaling, which in a log-log plot representation turns out to be a linear slope, and the slopes exactly correspond to the slope of 2 for the elastic part of the modulus versus 1 for the viscous part of the modulus. The intermediate plateau is frequency independent, and the very upper regime, the glassy regime, exhibits scaling of the storage and loss modulus, again, according to what we have seen in the Maxwell model. The storage modulus levels off in a frequency-independent, very high plateau then, whereas the loss modulus drops with a power law scaling of -1. What we have in between is the so-called leather-like regime, where both quantities, storage and loss modulus, have values very close to each other, so this is a typical viscoelastic regime, and exhibit power law scalings with a power of 1/2 each. To understand that, we must take a little detour and consider two elementary theories that describe how polymers, and the segments inside of them, actually move, because this is what's happening here. When considering this and putting this into formulas, we can actually quantitatively understand the rheological spectra that we have just discussed. Let us do so. The first elementary model for describing polymer motion and dynamics is the Rouse model. This does conceptually describe a polymer chain to be composed of a sequence of n spherical beads connected to each other by massless springs of root mean square length L. The beads represent the monomer segments, the springs represent the bonds between the monomer segments, as it's depicted in figure 4.19. In this model, each bead is assigned an individual friction coefficient, F segment. So this means friction by an external medium is exerted with each and every single segment. Or in other words, a surrounding solvent freely drains through the coil, hits each segment, and exerts friction with each segment. As a result, the total friction coefficient of this coil is simply the sum of the individual segmental friction coefficients. F total is n times F segment. Within this kind of modeling, we can quite easily estimate the translational diffusion coefficient that we would expect for such a coil. We simply derive it from the elementary Einstein equation, which tells us that the diffusion coefficient is equal to the driving energy, KBT, and the drag, as given by the friction coefficient. And if we express this for the case at hand here, we end up with equation 4.74. The diffusion coefficient in the Rouse case is thermal energy over the total friction coefficient. This means thermal energy over n times segmental friction coefficient. That means it's proportional to the degree of polymerization n with a power of -1. We can now go further and formulate an Einstein-Smoluchowski analog expression for the timescale it takes to achieve displacement over exactly one coil size. This denotes as the so-called Rouse time, as it's given in equation 4.75. Tau Rouse is the distance of motion, in this case corresponding to the coil size, r square, over the diffusion coefficient, which in this case is the Rouse diffusion coefficient, times a geometrical factor, 2 times small d, where the small d is the geometrical dimensionality, 1, 2, or 3. If we replace the Rouse diffusion coefficient by equation 4.74, we end up with the right-hand side notation of equation 4.75. It gives us the Rouse time, which is the time it takes for the coil to move over distances equal to its own size. On timescales longer than that, the coils can do so and can macroscopically move. This means this Rouse time delimits the time it takes to actually achieve macroscopic flow. We can also think about doing the same estimate for another characteristic time, the time it takes for a single monomer unit inside the coil to move over distances equal to its own size. This is expressed in equation 4.76. We have gotten to this equation by doing the very same as we have done in the context of equation 4.75. We have considered the time, here tau zero, that it takes to move a distance of the squared monomer segmental size, L square, over 2 times dimensionality times Rouse diffusion coefficient. When we now make ourselves clear that in very general, a polymer chain is an object of size r is equal to n with the power of nu, the Flory exponent, times L, and use that to replace the r square in equation 4.75, the equation for the Rouse time, and furthermore replace the factor f segment over 2 times dimensionality times kbt in it by the very analog factor that also occurs in equation 4.76, we obtain equation 4.77. This equation connects the 2 elementary relaxation times for polymers in the Rouse model. Its longest relaxation time, the Rouse time, and its shortest relaxation time, tau zero. And they are connected to each other by the number of segments with a power law exponent of 1 plus 2 nu. These latter 2 times combine the 2 characteristics of a so-called relaxation time spectrum. On timescales shorter than tau zero, no relaxation whatsoever is possible. This time is so short that not even single monomer units can relax over distances equal to their own size. And from timescales tau rouse on, any relaxation is possible. Here, even the entire coil can move over distances equal to its own size. And between these 2 extremes, we have a multiple of further relaxation times, denoting as the relaxation of pairs, doubles, triples, quadruples, quintuples of monomer unit groups over distances equal to their respective own sizes. That means on timescales longer than tau rouse, the polymer is a viscous liquid. On timescales shorter than tau zero, the polymer is an elastic solid, to be precise, a glassy elastic solid. And on timescales in between, it's a viscoelastic material. Another model to conceptualize the motion of polymers, both as a whole and inside of them, is the Zim model. This model takes into account so-called hydrodynamic interactions. These are couplings between monomer segments mediated by the solvent in between. We can conceptualize this to us as follows. If we regard a monomer unit that moves into a certain direction, then the solvent molecules right next to it are dragged along with that and also move in this direction. Those in turn drag their neighboring solvent molecules in the very same direction. Those drag their neighboring molecules and so on and so forth until at some point a further monomer segment is dragged to also move into this direction. This mechanism induces a hydrodynamic coupling between the motion of the monomer units. This means in this case, the solvent inside of the coil is trapped by those hydrodynamic interactions. So the coil is not freely drained as it was in the Rouse model, but by contrast, not drained. It has, of course, solvent inside of it, but this is trapped inside of the coil due to hydrodynamic interactions. As a result, the polymer coils here appear like solvent-filled nanogel particles, as it's indicated in figure 4.20. Again, we can estimate the translational diffusion coefficient from this by a Stokes-Einstein kind of equation by making us clear that here now these nanogel particles diffuse as a whole entity such that the diffusion coefficient in the Zim model turns out to be the driving energy, kbt, over friction, which here is simply the Stokes-type friction for a spherical object, 6 pi eta rh, whereby rh is the hydrodynamic radius of our object, here our solvent-filled coil. That we can replace by the scaling law for polymers in solvents, which is n with the power of nu, Flory exponent, times L, segmental length. So this means in this case, the chain length dependence, the dependence on the degree of polymerization of the diffusion coefficient, is not n with the power of minus 1, as it was in the Rouse model, but only n with the power of minus nu. So it is less pronounced. And this makes sense. Here, friction with the surrounding solvent is only exerted by the frontal face of these nanogel particles. The solvent does not freely drain through the coil and hit any segment in the coil, but only those on the frontal surface. And so if we consider a larger coil with more monomer segments, of course there is more friction and so more dragging and so less diffusivity, but not as pronounced as it would be in the Rouse scenario, where each and every further segment contributes to further friction. As we have done in the Rouse model, we can also formulate again an Einstein-Smoluchowski type of expression for the timescale of displacement by exactly one coil size, which is now named Zim time in the Zim model, as denoted in equation 4.79. Here, due to the different dependence of the Zim diffusion coefficient on the degree of polymerization, according to equation 4.78, the connection between the longest relaxation time, which is here named Zim time, and the shortest relaxation time, which is again tau zero, is different than in the Rouse model. There is not a factor of n with a power of 1 plus 2 nu in it, but here n with a power law exponent of 3 nu, which is again smaller than in the Rouse scenario. And again, the reason for this is the absence of solvent draining in the ZIM model, which comes along with less viscous drag, causing the time it takes for the coil to diffuse a given distance, here its own distance, to be shorter than in the case of the more pronounced viscous drag in the Rouse model. Again, between these two extremes of the relaxation time spectrum, we have a multitude of further relaxation times, which correspond to the relaxation of doubles, triples, quadruples, quintuples, and higher groups of monomer segments over distances equal to their own sizes. We name these relaxations so-called relaxation modes, and enumerate them by a mode index P. The pth mode corresponds to the coherent motion of subchains with n over p segments in a whole chain with n segments. At p being 1, coherent motion of the entire chain is possible, meaning that the entire chain can relax and get displaced over distances equal to its own size, whereas at p being 2, each half of the chain can move coherently and thereby relax and get displaced over distances equal to their own size, and so on. At p being 3, each third of the chain relaxes over distances equal to its own size, and so on and so forth, until at p being n, only single monomer units relax and get displaced over distances equal to their own size. Figure 4.21 visualizes this hierarchy of relaxation modes. If we consider again an experiment where we abruptly deform our polymer, modes will start to relax, first the short ones, and then the longer ones, and at a time tau p after such an abrupt deformation, all the modes with index greater than p are relaxed, whereas all the modes with index below p are still unrelaxed. In very general, the energy storage upon deformation is of order of the number of segments times kbt. Roughly, each segment in the chain stores an energy increment of kbt. Upon release of the deformation, each mode relaxes a portion of kbt from that. This means that the stored energy drops from a total of kbt per segment at the shortest relaxation time, tau 0, to only kbt per chain at the longest relaxation time, tau Rouse or tau ZIM, depending on what model we use to describe that. And at an intermediate time, tau p, only p times kbt remains stored. Again, we can relate the intermediate relaxation time tau p to the elementary shortest relaxation time tau 0 by an identity similar to the identities 4.77 and 4.79. This gives us a formula as denoted in the second line of table 4.1. The relaxation time of the pth mode is calculated like it's done in equations 4.77 and 4.79 for the entire coil by simply considering the pth mode to be an own chain with shorter length, not with degree of polymerization n, like the whole coil is, but only with degree of polymerization n over p. And then, depending on whether we use the Rouse or ZIM model, we become different formulas for this. If we rearrange this equation for p, we obtain the time dependence of the mode index in the fourth line of this table. With those formulas, we're now able to quali and quantitatively discuss the full mechanical rheological spectrum that was shown to us as a real data set in a frequency representation in figure 4.17 and as a schematic representation over the inverse of frequency time, which also correlates to temperature, in figure 4.18. Let us first do a qualitative discussion of the different regimes and then add a quantitative viewpoint to it. We have actually dropped this already here and there in the preceding discussion, and now we bring it together systematically. For our discussion, we again regard a real data set as it's plotted in figure 4.22. This is the rheological spectrum, a master curve constructed out of different curve sections measured at different temperatures by application of the principle of time temperature superposition for 1,4 polybutadiene with a molar mass of 130,000 grams per mole, reference to room temperature, 25 degrees Celsius, which, by the way, is 124 degrees above its respective glass transition temperature. So this polymer has a very low glass transition temperature, meaning that it will display viscous flow properties not on extremely long timescales as the preceding example of the polyvinyl methyl ether in figure 4.17 did, but instead this polymer displays viscous properties on normal timescales. Let us do a full discussion of this mechanical spectrum from the right to the left on the frequency axis, meaning from short timescales, corresponding to high frequencies, to long timescales, corresponding to low frequencies. At very short timescales, corresponding to very high frequencies, and also to low temperatures, the elastic modulus has very high values in the range of gigapascals, and its storage part, G prime, levels off at a plateau where it outweighs the last part, G double prime, that lays underneath this plateau. This means that here the material is an elastic solid with more storage than loss properties. To be precise, what we have here is a glassy state of appearance. On these very short timescales, or low temperatures, no motion is possible of the sample's building blocks, neither of the polymer chains as a whole, nor just parts of them. This is because either temperature is so low that any motion is frozen, or because the timescale we consider is so short that these motions just cannot happen. As a result, we here have a sample with amorphous structure, but without any dynamics. A glass. And this glassy state features energy elastic mechanics with high values of the modulus, in the range of 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 pascals. At a first characteristic time, tau 0, the shortest possible relaxation time, which for the case of the example in figure 4.22 is around 0.3 nanoseconds, at least single monomeric units have enough time to relax, in a sense that they can move over distances equal to their own size. At times even longer than that, we sequentially activate relaxation modes, the coherent motion of doubles, triples, quadruples, quintuples, and higher order groups of monomer units. The polymer is then in a markedly viscoelastic, leather-like regime, where both storage and loss modulus, G prime and G double prime, have very similar values, and also similar time or frequency-dependent scaling in that range. The mechanical properties in that state can be treated analytically by the Rouse model, which applies for a polymer melt, as we have it here, or phenomenologically by the Kelvin-Voigt model, to treat the viscoelastic solid-like appearance of the specimen that we encounter here. Normally, we would expect this kind of relaxation to proceed until the longest relaxation mode is activated, the one corresponding to the Rouse time, from where on the material should then display purely viscous properties, with scaling of the two parts of the moduli according to the Maxwell model. And indeed, we see that regime in figure 4.22, on the very left-hand side of the diagram. In between, however, there is another regime, where the storage part of the modulus exhibits a quite extended frequency-independent plateau, whereas the loss part of the modulus displays a minimum. The Rouse time, from whereupon we would actually expect terminal viscous relaxation to set in, is actually also marked in this diagram. It lays at about 0.5 milliseconds. But it's not anyhow recognizable in the mechanical spectrum, as it lays right in this domain of the intermediate frequency-independent plateau of the storage modulus. What does cause this plateau? We see that its onset occurs from a certain further characteristic time on that is named tau e in figure 4.22. It's around 0.1 microsecond for the given example. Here, the polymer chain segments that relax do for the first time realize that they mutually block each other from further relaxation due to mechanical entanglement with each other. This constraint hinders them from further relaxing in the leather-like regime, but instead, now the mutual chain entanglement prohibits this until we reach timescales long enough for the chains to disentangle from each other. This is the time tau rep indicated as the longest characteristic time in the example in figure 4.22, here given as typically 0.2 seconds. In the time domain, between tau rep, which is also named reptation time, and tau e, the entanglement time, the sample has the appearance like it would be permanently cross-linked, like a piece of rubber, a polymer network. The chains are mutually entangled with each other, and the time is already long enough for the chain segments to realize these entanglements, because they can already move over distances in that range, but cannot yet actually displace against each other, because their mutual entanglement hinders them to do so. To lose the entanglement, much longer times are required, because the losing of entanglements occurs by a delicate mechanism, which is named the reptation mechanism. That occurs on timescales of tau rep. By and large, reptation is also a model concept to describe the motion of chains in such a state, in such an entangled state. What we basically do in this theory is we focus ourselves on just one chain in the sample and model its direct environment, which consists of many entanglement points with other chains, like a rigid solid tube. This high level of constraint in the vicinity of the chain along the chain contour prohibits the chain to move perpendicular to its chain contour, but by contrast allows it to only creep by curvilinear motion in the direction along its contour, like a reptile that is trapped in a tube and creeps out of the tube. And that process takes one reptation time. Within the reptation theory, we can derive formulas that give us this reptation time. For example, as a function of the chain length, the degree of polymerization. Footnote in this context, this reptation theory was also derived by the French physicist Pierre-Gilles Degen, the Nobel Prize laureate of the year 1991, who has introduced the term soft matter. In the plateau domain, if we deform our sample, the entanglement points act as if they would be permanent crosslinks. Of course, they are not permanent crosslinks, but in this time window between the entanglement time and the reptation time, they have infinite lifetimes, because the lifetime is the reptation time. And here we consider times shorter than the reptation time. So this means here, stretching the sample does lead to an entropy elastic response, like also crosslinked polymer network rubbers display. Basically, what happens here is that upon stretching the specimen, we stretch every chain segment between two crosslinking points, or here, between two entanglement points. If we treat these chain segments as ideal chains, each of which responds like an entropic spring by the concept of entropy elasticity of ideal polymer chains. The reason for this entropic response is that stretching of chains on a microscopic scale is most easily accommodated by rotating single bonds against each other into a wider local transconformation. This does not cost considerable energy amounts to be put in, but it comes along with a drop in entropy. As we have seen already in our introductory soft matter unit, the most favorable natural shape of a polymer is a random coil, which microscopically is realized by a wild mixture of local close cis or wider transconformations. If we now stretch this chain segment, we take away cis conformations and make trans conformations out of them, meaning we make the coil more ordered, and that comes along with a penalty in entropy. Well, in a network, this happens for each and every single network strand segments between cross-linking points, or here in our case, entanglement points, causing an entropy elastic response. Basically, we can by our large estimate the energy that is stored upon deformation to be about thermal energy per network strand, KBT per network strand, which in the case of a cross-linked rubber or an entangled polymer melt in its rubbery plateau, typically corresponds to values of the modulus of around 10 to the 6 Pascal, as we also see it in figure 4.22. On timescales longer than the reptation time, the mutual chain entanglement can disappear, the chains can disentangle from each other, move over distances longer than their own size by the reptation mechanism, and then the sample enters the terminal viscous flow regime. Here, the last part of the modulus, G double prime, is greater than G prime, whereby the first scales with a power law exponent of 1, whereas the other scales with a power law exponent of 2, in a frequency-dependent representation like in figure 4.22. This causes that the G double prime outweighs the G prime even more the lower the frequency is, which makes sense. The lower the frequency is, the longer is the time, and the more time we give the material for relaxing, of course, the better can the building blocks macroscopically move and the sample show flow. Quantitatively, this scaling is simply given by the Maxwell model. Also, the scaling on the very other end of the spectrum, in the glassy regime, is also given by the Maxwell model. Here, the storage part of the modulus outweighs the loss part of the modulus, whereby the first scales with omega with a power of 0, meaning it doesn't depend on frequency. It goes into a frequency-independent high-value plateau, whereas the latter drops with increasing frequency with a power law scaling of minus 1. The intermediate rubbery elastic plateau shows a frequency-independent scaling of the storage modulus, which here outweighs the loss modulus, as here relaxation of the chains is halted, so to speak, by their mutual entanglement. And in the intermediate regime of the leather-like viscoelastic relaxation of sub-chain relaxation modes, we have the moduli G prime and G double prime to displaying very similar values. The curve are very close to each other in that section of figure 4.22, displaying a scaling that is given by the time dependence of the mode index, because what is happening here is sequential activation of relaxation times. And so the time dependence of the moduli occurs by the time dependent activation of higher and higher relaxation modes, and that is expressed by the time dependence of the modulus, which was given to us in the last, in the fourth line of table 4.1. As we don't have a time dependence in figure 4.22, but instead a frequency dependence, we simply have to flip the exponent, meaning the scaling in the framework of the Rouse model, doesn't occur with minus 1 over 1 plus 2 nu, as it's given in the fourth line of table 4.1, but with plus 1 over 1 plus 2 nu. And if we plug in a value for nu for the Flory exponent, as it's typical for polymer melts, which is the ideal value, 1/2, this whole scaling exponent turns out to be 1/2. And this is exactly the frequency-dependent scaling we have in the leather-like regime in figure 4.22. Figure 4.23 does again summarize the conceptual and also quantitative discussion that we have just led. In the upper two schematic sketches, we see the relaxation spectrum schematically that we would expect for simple polymers that are not entangled with each other, either in the context of Rouse or Zim type description. At low frequencies, we have free viscous relaxation, whereas at higher frequencies, we have viscoelastic leather-like relaxation of relaxation modes, scaling according to what is given for the time dependence of the mode index in the Rouse or Zim framework. In the lower part of this figure, we see two real data sets for samples that correspond to those regimes. One is for polyvinyl pyridine in an HCl solution, which is a polyelectrolyte sample that displays Rouse type dynamics, whereas the other is polystyrene in its theta solvent, which is a typical polymer solution displaying Zim type dynamics. The chains in those samples are short enough to not show entanglement. If the chain length increases to show entanglement, an intermediate plateau squeezes itself in, as it's shown in figure 4.24 for the example of polystyrene with different molar masses. Here we see that a plateau comes in with an extension greater and greater and greater the higher the molar masses. On the very right-hand side, chains are so short that they cannot entangle with each other, showing mechanical spectra similar to the ones shown in the previous figure, whereas from a chain length of about 50,000 on, entanglement starts to get possible and an intermediate plateau emerges and gets greater in extension the longer the chain length is, respectively the higher the molar masses. All the plateaus end in a terminal flow region where the modulus scales with a slope of 2, according to what the Maxwell model can explain to us. Whereas in the other extreme, the moduli bend over to a slope of 1/2, as derivable from the Rouse model. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. It has been very rich in content. We have seen how relaxation and creep processes in viscoelastic materials can superimpose, and how time and temperature are superpositionable. This gives us a great advantage in assessing rheological spectra, because it allows us to replace these two variables by each other, or to have them add upon each other. By recording rheological datasets on commonly accessible time or frequency ranges at different temperatures, and then constructing rheological master curves out of this by applying the principle of time-temperature superposition. Those master curves will have characteristic shapes with 3 or even 4 different sections that we have understood in this lesson unit, both conceptually and quantitatively. We have also recognized that there is striking universality when taking the glass transition as the reference and the glass transition temperature as the reference temperature. This indicates that the glassy state and the glass transition are very interesting, carrying very deep universal physical characteristics. And this shall be the focus of our next lesson unit.